both filled with joy and anger and fear, and the parent is filled with both relief and guilt. So in the same moment, there is so much happening for both parent and child, and the trajectory of that affects these children. So it's not just the moment of separation, but we know that this carries on throughout their lives for many of these children.
I want to read from the letter you wrote. To try and argue that this policy of ripping children from the parents at the border is somehow different from the systematic traumatization of children during the times of slavery, forced assimilation, and the Holocaust is to disregard history. To somehow convince ourselves the systematic traumatization of children has no bearing on the lives of these children, no impact on the legacy of our country, is to be living in an alternate universe, and to not care about the impact of these policies have on children is to succumb to the worst potential of humanity. The intergenerational effect of this, Dr. Sinopoli.
Yes. So I'll try and really put this slowly, but we know that that which is so overwhelming to the mind, that for which there are no words, these unspeakable, unformulated traumatic experiences, they get passed down to the next generation. And a really fine example of that is that after 9/11, there was a report in this book, Lost in Transmission, of a
sidewalk scene
on Fifth
Avenue. And we're going to go to that
report
in part two of our conversation, Dr. Sinopoli, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. Psychologist Dr. Sinopoli, our guest. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Good afternoon. The time is 5 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor IranForm, U.S. Withdrawal from Nuclear Agreement and Path to War, on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. The Iran Forum will feature Jamal Abdi, Executive Director of the National Iran American Council, journalist Reese Ehrlich, and local speakers in a discussion about withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal. The sponsoring groups are involved in prevention of war and in supporting diplomacy and friendship with the people of Iran. Again, that's the Iran Forum U.S. Withdrawal from the Nuclear Agreement and Path to War on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Cherry Blossom Orchestra on Wednesday, June 27th at 8 p.m. at the No Vacancy Lounge in Portland. The evening centers on the historic performance of Jansen Hop, a piece of music written in Portland in 1931 to be performed at Jansen Beach's Golden Canopy Ballroom. It was never recorded. The night also features a 90th birthday tribute for Louis Armstrong's West End Blues and much more. Again, that's the Cherry Blossom Orchestra on Wednesday, June 27th at 8 p.m. at the No Vacancy Lounge, 235 Southwest 1st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portlanders talk back about the thoughts of U.S. immigrant policies and the Occupy ICE PDX encampment.
The U.S. Supreme Court rules in favor of the Muslim ban.
And in international news, Italy continues to send an immigrant ship sailing. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 26, 2018. I'm Elizabeth Venable.
And I'm Kyle Carrezzi. The Supreme Court's ruling on Trump versus Hawaii was handed down this morning and by a vote of 5-4, President Trump's travel ban was upheld despite being challenged by the state of Hawaii. On January 27, 2017, President Trump signed an initial executive order barring citizens of Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen from entering the United States for 90 days. President Trump's order was quickly decried by masses, many of whom rushed to international airports to protest the policy. On July 28, 2017, Federal District Court Judge Ann M. Donnelly of New York held that a portion of the executive order violated one's right to due process, found in the 5th and 14th Amendments of the Constitution, as well as the Equal Protection Clause, also found in the 14th Amendment. Days later, on February 3rd, 2017, Federal District Court Judge James Robart of Washington ordered that the travel ban be halted nationwide and asserted that the states who have filed lawsuits against President Trump, quote, have met their burden of demonstrating that they face immediate and irreparable injury as a result of the signing and implementation of the executive order, unquote. Following a hearing in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on February 7, 2017, in which arguments were presented by lawyers from the Justice Department and the Washington State Solicitor General, two out of the three judges affirmed the halting of the travel ban in February 9, 2017. While there was nearly a month-long reprieve from Trump's first executive order being blocked, on March 6, 2017, another executive order was issued detailing a similar ban on entrance by foreign nationals for 90 days and adding that refugees from the countries originally included, with the exception of Iraq, which was exempt from the second executive order, could not enter for 120 days. One day later, attorneys for the state of Hawaii filed a lawsuit against the federal government and asked for a temporary restraining order to mitigate the implementation of the executive order. On March 15, 2017, U.S. District Court Judge Derek Watson of Hawaii acquiesced and granted the temporary restraining order, which applied nationwide. In a final blow to the second draft of the travel ban prior to today's Supreme Court ruling, on March 29, 2017, Judge Derek Watson claimed that the core provisions of the revised travel ban violated the Establishment Clause, found in the First Amendment of the Constitution, seeing it as a discriminatory towards Muslims. Although there was another period of rejoice following the second discontinuance of the travel ban, on September 24, 2017, the Trump administration unveiled additional restrictions on foreigners from North Korea, Syria, Chad, Yemen, Libya, Somalia, Iran, and Venezuela. As released, these restrictions were more extensive in comparison to Trump's previous executive orders, with countries being divided into groups and each group being subjected to different regulations. However, the focus of the overreaching regulations remained on limiting entry of foreigners, regardless of immigration status.
Despite numerous legal battles between the states and the Trump administration in federal, district, and circuit courts, the Supreme Court rejected the state's challenges to President Trump's executive order on the basis of executive authority, rejecting Hawaii's claim of Establishment Clause unconstitutionality, the, quote, sufficient national security justification, end quote. The majority opinion was written by Chief Justice John Roberts, with Justices Kennedy, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch joining. Beginning with Hawaii's assertion that the September 2017 order exceeded the president's authority in regards to federal immigration law, Roberts rejected Hawaii's claim and cited the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965 in support of his ruling. The Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, enacted under the 89th Congress and former President Lyndon B. Johnson, undercut the previous national origin-based quota system, which had been typically based towards Northern European immigrants. While this act holds its own place in American history, Roberts cited Section 1182F of the 1965 Act, quote, by its terms, Section 1182F exudes deference to the president in every clause. It entrusts to the president the decisions whether and when to suspend entry, whose entry to suspend, for how long, and on what conditions, end quote. In furthering his point, Roberts stated that the president explicitly has the authority to block entry of those who he believes will be detrimental to the interests of the U.S. In their lawsuit, Hawaii made another claim that President Trump's order violated an additional statute of federal immigration law, turning to Section 1152, which prohibits discrimination in the allocation of visas based on national origin. While Roberts acknowledges the merit of this claim, he noted that this does not preclude presidents from blocking entry to nationals of some countries. Quote, presidents have repeatedly exercised their authority to suspend entry on the basis of nationality. Using former presidents Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter as examples of executives who have exercised this power. Finally, the majority examined the claim that President Trump's orders were unconstitutional based on the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which proclaims that one religion cannot be favored over another by the federal government. Roberts' standing on this held that because the order only applied to 8% of the world's Muslim population and only acknowledged countries which had been previously designated as posing potential national security risk by Congress, the order didn't violate the Establishment Clause. Two dissenting opinions were flying, one being written by Justice Stephen Breyer, joined by Justice Elena Kagan, and the other being written by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, joined by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. In Breyer's opinion, he pinpointed the fact that while the majority focused on the ability for special exemptions to be granted through the waiver program, there was evidence that this program was not in practice or providing relief. In Sotomayor's opinion, she aggressively denounced the majority's opinion by stating, quote, the president's statements, which the majority utterly fails to address in its legal analysis, strongly support the conclusion that the proclamation was issued to express hostility toward Muslim and exclude them from the country. Drawing parallels between the irrevocable stain of the 1944 case, Korematsu versus United States, which upheld Japanese-American internment camps during World War II, and Trump versus Hawaii.
The Occupy ICE encampment stands firm on the ICE Portland headquarters on Southwest McAdam Boulevard, despite orders from federal officials to disband the protest. Many civilians are in strong support about those willing to put their lives on the line at the encampment. Some feel on the fence or undecided, while others fear the efforts at Occupy ICE PDX are hindering help for immigrants. KBOO's Teresa Mitchell and Summer Barraza hit the streets earlier this afternoon to ask Portlanders in West Portland what they think about the Occupy ICE PDX and the immigration conflicts in Oregon.
Excuse me, have you heard about the blockade of the ICE building? Do you support that?
I have heard of it. I'm not sure how I feel about it yet. So, sorry.
What causes you concerns?
You guys are going to have to wait a second. I've heard from some people who are actually helping refugees that it might get in the way of them helping them. So there are some concerns from people who are trying to help refugees that the blockade might get in the way of them trying to help. And they've heard this from legal counsel as well. So I understand the motivations. I understand what they're trying to do. I'm not 100% sure that it's not going to have some unintended consequences.
It's really great to see people taking power into their own hands and really making a change.
I'm just visiting. I only just heard about it. I'm very much in favor of it.
Well, I hope it continues until all of the children that were separated from their families are returned.
My opinion is it's lucky that some of us are brave enough to go there and sit on the front line.
I don't watch the news. So when I heard ICE, I'm like, I don't like that. But I like that there's people blocking them. He had to tell me. They're blocking them in, right? That's what's happening? I like it.
For KBOO News, I'm Summer Barraza.
For KBOO News, I'm Teresa Mitchell.
The Occupy ICE encampment on Southwest McAdam Avenue is in its second week, and organizers say they are in it for the long haul. Danielle is a designated media spokesperson for the camp. Our reporter asked her about the Department of Homeland Security's officers that entered the camp yesterday to hand out flyers telling people to move or be subject to arrest.
They came heavily armed with ARs. They were walking around on the roof. Slightly scary scene, just because... You going through what we're going through with such tender lives, my heart is with the babies because they are the ones that are defenseless. They cannot come out and stand on the front lines with us. They can't, some of them, speak for themselves and say, hey, I'm hurting, or hey, someone is mistreating me. So the fact that they can't, a lot of them can't advocate for themselves is really heartbreaking. What they're doing and how they're treating these kids, it infuriates me. It hurts my heart. I feel like while you label someone an illegal alien, I feel like that's stamping them non-human. And people fall in line with that too much. so much so that you have people in there making fun of the kids, a baby crying, you know, yearning for the suckle of its mother's milk, for the nourishment of its body. All those come into mind when I'm thinking, God, these babies.
Do you sense that ICE is going to provoke a confrontation with the camp?
I think that was a little bit of a feeling last night because things were really eerie out here. We would like to continue to move forward in raising awareness and showing solidarity and being there for our brown brothers and sisters and, yeah, continuing to grow this camp and show people, lead by example, this can happen. It's happening.
More than 230 rescued migrants from Libya traveled across the sea to find sanctuary in Western European countries on the ship Lifeline. Without ever reaching a destination, they had spent 5 days at sea before docking in Malta. According to the BBC, the Interior Minister of Italy, Matteo Salvini, accused the organization-operated ships of being, quote, being a taxi service for migrants, as well as saying that the migrants were putting themselves in danger for sailing the ships. Lifeline's Twitter page has also announced that one of the migrants on the ship had become ill and had to be evacuated in Malta, where the Maltese government has accepted the migrants on the ship Monday night. Many other migrants on the ship also suffered from medical conditions. According to thetimes.co.uk, Malta's acceptance of migrants was a good example of Salvini's promise to halt migrants crossing into Italy. The Times.co.uk quotes a tweet from Salvini, quote, "The doors are open for women and children genuinely fleeing from war, but not for all the rest," unquote. Countries such as France, who are willing to take a dozen migrants, and Portugal had agreed to take the ship. Spain and the Netherlands took after Salvini and refused access to migrants when Lifeline announced their rescue of the Libyan migrants. While these countries are deciding to have agreed to take migrants in, European governments were in an altercation for days trying to decide who would assume responsibility for the degrading ships sailing onto the continent's southern shores.
A proposal to ban grocery taxes in Oregon will appear on the November 6th ballot later this year. Proponents of the measure submitted over 121,000 signatures in order to include the issue on the upcoming ballot. The Oregon Ban Tax on Groceries Initiative, or Measure 103, would amend part of the state constitution which currently allows state and local government to enact taxes on the sale of food or beverage items. This measure would not affect taxes on alcohol, tobacco, or marijuana. However, it would prevent future taxes on junk food and sugary drinks. A yes vote is in favor of amending the Oregon Constitution to prevent state and local government from enacting taxes on groceries, while a no vote would maintain the state constitution and continue to give state and local government the power to tax certain food items. Currently, Oregon has no statewide sales tax, so groceries are not subject to state taxation. The campaign in support of this measure has largely been funded by major grocery corporations. Albertsons, Safeway, Kroger, Costco, and Thunderbird Market have contributed nearly $2 million in support of the initiative. Proponents argue that the initiative will ensure groceries are never taxed in Oregon, while opponents worry that the measure will have other overreaching consequences. The initiative would prevent state and local government from enacting a sugary drink tax or soda tax, such as those already in place in other U.S. cities, including Seattle, San Francisco, and Philadelphia. If passed, the measure would also block the tax on sugary sodas that has been proposed in Multnomah County.
The Oregon Attorney General's office noted that the initiative would also prevent grocery retailers from being subject to changes in Oregon's minimum corporate tax rate. Mary King, a retired economics professor from Portland State University, stated that the measure is, quote, "a massive, unprecedented carve-out for some of the biggest retailers in the world that will apply to far more than just the food they sell," unquote. The union-supported group Our Oregon has raised similar concerns that the grocery tax ban is too broad, arguing that the measure could extend beyond grocery aisles, potentially affecting restaurants, movie theaters, and even can and bottle redemption centers. If approved by voters, the Oregon initiative will be the first statewide ban on grocery taxes in the United States. A similar measure is passed in Washington State, where campaigners have until July 6th to submit the necessary signatures. The city of Seattle has already enacted a $1.75 per fluid ounce tax on sugar-sweetened beverages, which took effect on January 1st. Seattle has collected more than $4 million in first quarter tax payments. These funds will be used to subsidize health food projects, early learning programs, community college scholarships, and other administrative costs. The ban tax on groceries initiative would prevent any similar sugary drink taxes from being enacted by state or local government in Oregon. Measure 103 will be heavily publicized by both supporters and opponents as the November 6th election draws closer.
Community college students can rejoice knowing that Portland State University will let them transfer tuition-free under their Transfers Finish Free program for the fall 2018 term. However, not just any transferring community college student can qualify. To be eligible, the student has to complete the free application for student federal aid, have a GPA of 2.0 or above, enroll full-time, have limited Pell Grant usage, and be eligible for the federal Pell Grant. The federal Pell Grant is only available to students whose families make a maximum of $50,000. Families who make around or less than $20,000 are more likely to receive the federal grant. Families, in quotes, is the key word in applying for the federal Pell Grant, and this is especially troubling when it comes to being a student who makes their own income, lives on their own, or has trouble coordinating with a parent to fill out the FAFSA. FAFSA still considers these students as dependents. Studentaid.ed.gov lists the ways a student could file as independent, such as being married, being a U.S. veteran, orphaned, being 24 years old before December 31st when you are applying for federal aid. If this process to transfer with free tuition seems complicated, speaking to any financial counselor at any community college could help figure out how to qualify.
Disney is recruiting extras for an upcoming movie shoot in Portland. For the movie Timmy Failure, inspired by a popular series of children's books about a child detective. The movie stars an 11-year-old boy named Timmy who thinks he's a hotshot detective, and Timmy runs a detective agency called Total Failures with his imaginary best friend, who is a polar bear. The movie will be directed by Tom McCarthy and written by Stephen Pestis, who writes the Timmy Failure book series as well. Disney will be shooting a part of the movie in Portland and is seeking extras for filming later this summer. Auditions are open to all, with no restrictions on age and no acting experience necessary. The movie will be filming in Portland between July 27th and September 8th. Grant Wilfley Casting Incorporated will be conducting casting in the area. On July 8th, GWC will be hosting a casting call between 11 a.m. and 4 p.m. at the Doubletree Hotel at 1000 Northeast Multnomah Street. Applications can also be sent to timmyfailure.bg@disneympp.com. Applications through email must include the applicant's name, phone number, a current picture, height, weight, clothing sizes, and whether or not you own a vehicle. Parents can also apply on behalf of their children. Disney plans to shoot different sections of the movie at locations across the United States. And now it's time for the weekly riddle that, if you can't solve it, it'll keep you awake at night. It's the point puzzle.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to take a girl's name in five letters, starting with a consonant and then a vowel. Move the first letter forward one consonant in the alphabet, and the second forward one vowel, and you will have another common girl's name. Do this again, and you will have a third common girl's name. Well, the answer is Kelly, Lily, and Molly. Our winner this week is Craig Jones, who listens to KPOV in Bend, Oregon.
Run, Molly, run. Run, Molly, run. Let us have some fun.
For the new puzzle, I have a summer barbecue math quiz for you. At your first barbecue of the season, two-thirds of your guests have hamburgers, half of your guests have corn on the cob, five people have both, and one person has neither. How many people are at the barbecue? So again, two-thirds of the guests have a hamburger, half of the guests have corn on the cob, there are five people who have both, and one person who has neither. If you want to see this in writing, visit the Point Puzzle page of the KPOV website, kpov.org. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org, and I'll select one winner from among any correct answers.
When you come to my house, come down behind the jail. I got a sign on my door, barbecue for sale. I'm talking about my barbecue.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of June 25th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
Thing. You starve and near exhaustion. Everything I've done,
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with members of the Rose Haven Day Center for Women and Children who will be discussing their programs. At 6, it's special public affairs programming. Then at 7, we have calculated conversations. Tonight's weather will cool down into the mid-50s tomorrow. Look for temperatures much the same as today with partially cloudy skies. Today in history, in 1948, U.S. and British pilots began the Berlin Airlift, which delivered food and supplies to the city after a blockade by the Soviet Union. And in 1963, President John F. Kennedy proclaimed solidarity with the people in Berlin, declaring during a speech in front of the wall, "Ich bin ein Berliner." The quote of the day is also from John F. Kennedy, who said, quote, "Let us not seek the Republican answer or the Democratic answer. Let us not seek to fix the blame for the past. Let us accept our own responsibility for the future."
I can't live within you.
California Governor Jerry Brown has declared a state of emergency in Lake County as the Pawnee wildfire has increased to over 11,000 acres. The fire, located in Northern California, which started Saturday evening, has so far destroyed 22 structures and enforced the evacuation of over 1,500 people while mobilizing fire departments from all around the Bay Area. The Red Cross has opened an evacuation center in the town of Lower Lake, which is located to the south of the fire. Evacuees have also taken shelter at the local Moose Lodge, with many camping in the parking lot. There have been no reported injuries to either firefighters or civilians. The cause of the fire is still under investigation.
In early April, teachers across Oklahoma took part in a massive walkout to demand raises and better funding for education. Oklahoma is a deep red state that has vigorously pursued tax cuts that have negatively affected teachers across the state. During the walkout, teachers marched to the Oklahoma State Capitol and successfully won raises of approximately $6,000, depending on experience. Other school support staff were awarded a raise of $1,250. Despite winning raises, many teachers were frustrated with a lack of more substantive legislation following the walkout. That frustration is now being channeled toward the ballot. Following the walkout, over 100 teachers declared that they intended to run for office. Now, according to Vice News, 98 teachers will appear on Tuesday primary ballot in Oklahoma.
Those 98 teachers make up 20% of those running for office in Oklahoma. Alberto Marejon, an 8th grade teacher and web administrator for the march at the state capitol, says that, quote, "There was a lot of frustration with how the walkout ended. A lot of teachers just came together and agreed that since the walkout didn't turn out the way we wanted, the next step is that we're going to remember when it comes time to vote." Oklahoma has the worst teacher funding in the U.S., and over the last 10 years, funding for teachers has slid almost 25%. 62% of teachers who declared their candidacy are female, and 61% are running as Democrats. Due to a low number of Democratic senators in the Oklahoma State Senate, many of the teachers are not running against the incumbent in their respective primaries. If they win their primaries, though, the real battle will come in November when the candidates will meet their incumbent opposition. One of the first to declare their candidacy after the walkout was Cindy Ralston, who, if she wins her primary, will face incumbent Kevin McDougall, who publicly opposed the walkout. McDougall said at the time of the walkout that, quote, "I'm not voting for another stinking measure when they're acting the way they're acting," end quote. McDougall later retracted his statements, but Ralston had had enough. Ralston states that, quote, teachers are basically non-confrontational people. They are really compassionate and have this drive to serve the public. But we just came to the realization that people don't understand education and what we need. If they're going to understand, teachers need to step up and help people understand, end quote. Primary results will be finalized Tuesday night.
Voters go to the polls in 7 states today in the latest round of primary and runoff elections. Primaries are in Colorado, Maryland, New York, Oklahoma, and Utah, while runoffs are being held in Mississippi and South Carolina. Here are the races to watch. In Colorado, the race for governor has drawn 4 candidates from each party to fill the seat being vacated by John Hickenlooper. A heavy favorite is left-wing Congressman Jared Polis, who has long advocated same-sex marriage and marijuana legislation and is running a platform that includes single-payer health care and state-funded preschool. If successful, he would be the first openly gay governor. In Maryland, the race for the Democratic nomination has been a heated contest between former NAACP President Ben Jealous and Prince George County Executive Washern Baker. Baker has the endorsement of former Governor Martin O'Malley, while Jealous is backed by Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris. The winner of this race will still have to face the popular incumbent Governor Larry Hogan in November. In Utah, the retirement of Senator Orrin Hatch has opened the door for former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney to make a bid for the Senate and is expected to gain an easy victory, despite his former heavy criticism of Donald Trump in this heavy red state. Oklahoma is another deep red state with the governorship up for grabs. Term limits are forcing our out incumbent Mary Fallon, and 10 Republicans are fighting for the nomination. Leading the pack are former Lieutenant Governor Todd Lamb and former Mayor Oklahoma City Mick Cornett. New York will see one of the most interesting contests of the night in the 11th Congressional District. Incumbent Representative Dan Donovan is to be challenged by former Representative Michael Grimm, who was convicted in 2014 of felony tax fraud. Donovan has received the endorsement of Donald Trump and had moved his position closer to the White House on issues such as the border wall. Grimm has been endorsed by former White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci. In South Carolina, incumbent Governor Henry McMaster is being challenged by businessman John Warren, with McMaster receiving the support of the White House. This race will be a test of strength of the Trump endorsement. The runoff in Mississippi will decide the challenger to Senator Roger Wicker will either be State Representative David Baraya or venture capitalist Howard Sherman. Sherman has had the backing of actors Alec Baldwin and Robert De Niro, who have hosted a fundraiser for him.
Next, we hear from Black History 365, produced out of the studios of KPFT Houston.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is June 26th. On this day in 1962, the Passive Resistance Movement began in Cairo, Illinois. The demonstrations were used against the segregation against people of color in public places. The strategy was used during the Civil Rights Movement and inspired others to fight for change. Today, the same passive resistance movement is still used to fight for equality.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
Next, we hear from Climate Connections, produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. In today's episode, the former mayor of Miami was moved by pre-dawn conversations over coffee.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Jose Regalado was not always an early riser, but after his mother passed away, Jose moved back home. And he started getting up at 4:30 each morning to join his father, Tomas, for a cup of Cuban coffee.
We started just chatting about everything,
including climate change. Tomas was the mayor of Miami at the time, but Jose says his father had not thought much about the topic. He was more focused on his constituents' concerns about mortgages and taxes.
for a lot of people, they're really just focused on the next month, not necessarily the next 20, 40, 50 years.
But during their pre-dawn chats, Jose helped his dad see that global warming is a here-and-now problem, too. More frequent floods caused by rising seas damage homes, close roads, and disrupt businesses in the city. Mayor Regalado was moved to action. He proposed a $400 million bond, which passed last year before he left office. Almost half the money will be used to reduce flooding, for example, by installing pumps and seawalls.
And he realized that he had a chance to make a difference. It really was just because he thought it was right, and I'm really proud of him for that.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to national Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. New statistics from a Canadian government agency show that nearly half of all young people in the country's jails are Indigenous. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, it has some activists pointing to racism.
The data is coming from Statistics Canada. The agency says for the years 2016-2017, 46% of admissions to correctional services were made up by Aboriginal youth. At the same time, Indigenous youth makes up only 8% of the youth population. Data shows that the numbers of young people being incarcerated across Canada have been declining, but for Aboriginal youth, it's been on the rise. The numbers are highest in the Western Canadian provinces of Saskatchewan and Manitoba. Michael Redhead Champagne is the founder of Aboriginal Youth Opportunities in Winnipeg. He's an activist whose work is aimed at supporting Indigenous youth. Champagne says he's not surprised by the numbers.
I have seen Indigenous and non-Indigenous children commit the same crime, and the Indigenous child get a record, a probation worker, and the non-Indigenous child is, you know, slap on the wrist, and, you know, we don't want to ruin this child's life.
Howard Sapers is an independent government advisor on correctional reform. Sapers says there is little way to escape the conclusion that there are some systemic biases built into the system that are contributing to this overrepresentation. He adds that some policies, such as mandatory minimum sentences, have also had a disproportionate impact on Native communities. Most activists agree that some changes are needed and soon. Champagne says the concern is that there is a cycle of institutionalizing Native children, first when they are taken into care, then assigned a caseworker, curfews, and rules. Then as they age, they graduate to the criminal justice system. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Tribal leaders in the West want to make sure federal officials listen to their questions and concerns about Trump administration plans to reorganize the Department of the Interior, which oversees Indian affairs. Taos Pueblo Governor Gilbert Suazo was among tribal leaders at a consultation Monday in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Suazo says as sovereign governments, tribes need to have a say in any changes.
Rather than have us adjust to one administration's idea on how things should work, they should look at the tribes and see how we've been functioning. And granted, you know, there's issues and problems from time to time. And, you know, we've been able to make corrections in different ways. Consultation with the tribes is so important that they need to hear from the tribes and hopefully take that message, work with the message that they're hearing from those people that are out there that are going to be affected by any reorganization.
Trump administration officials say the reorganization is to improve effectiveness. Tribal consultation sessions are being held across the country through early August. The Crow tribe in Montana cannot account for $14.5 million intended for transportation improvements, according to investigators. The Associated Press reports a federal audit shows payments cannot be accounted for between 2012 to 2017. The tribe has pointed to inadequate accounting. The current chairman, A.J. Not Afraid, has vowed to clean up mismanagement of grants and programs which have occurred over the past decade. Cheyenne and Arapaho artist Harvey Pratt's design has been selected for the National Native American Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. The multimedia artist is also a Vietnam veteran. Congress commissioned the National Museum of the American Indian to build the memorial. The museum conducted an international competition. Pratt's Warrior Circle of Honor design will undergo further development with the museum. The memorial is slated to open in 2020. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Joining Belgium, Denmark, France, and Spain, the Netherlands is now banning full face veils from public buildings. Such public buildings include most notably schools, government offices, and hospitals. According to Al Jazeera, the lower house of Dutch parliament passed a bill in 2016, and the upper house has now passed a bill into law. As has been the case across Europe, those who support banning facial veils present a situation in an issue of safety. Those who oppose such bans see it as a way to suppress expression of the Muslim faith in Europe. The main advising body for the Dutch government declared in 2015 that choosing to wear a veil is protected under the right to freedom of religion, but this law flies in the face of that verdict. The Netherlands already have existing legislation that prohibits the use of face veils, like the burqa and the niqab, on public transport and in schools. Although the ban does not extend to public streets, police are allowed to ask anyone to remove anything covering their face in order to identify the person. According to Annelies Morris, a professor of anthropology and sociology at the University of Amsterdam, the law, quote, is actually virtually a complete ban because the only spaces that are still available for women who wear face-covering clothing are the street and the private sector. It is completely disproportionate, and only effect will be that many of these women will stay at home even less, unquote. Morris continues, saying that the women who wear the veils will not have an opportunity to go to school, they will not have an opportunity to go to learn to swim, and all of those things. European countries that have instituted similar bans have not admitted to the ban being directed at Muslim women and their veils, but that has not been the case in the Netherlands. Far-right politician Geert Wilders has advocated for this ban for over a decade. Wilders belongs to the Freedom Party, which declared the ban a victory for the Netherlands. Senator Marjolein Fabara van de Klaashorst referred to the passage of the ban as, quote, a historical day because this is the first step to de-Islamize the Netherlands, unquote. There has been no report as to whether the ban will be challenged in Dutch courts.
Harley Davidson, an icon American manufacturing prowess, announced on Monday, June 25th, that they may shift some production of bikes overseas to mitigate the gripping reactionary tariffs implemented by the European Union following President Trump's continuing trade war. While it may seem iconoclastic for Harley Davidsons to not be manufactured overseas, this is not the first time Harley Davidsons have moved to foreign countries. In 2011, Harley opened a plant in Bhawal, India, in order to avoid India's 100% tariff on imported motorcycles, a tariff which would have priced even the cheapest Harley at nearly $14,000. In 2017, Harley announced that they were building a plant in Thailand, purposefully situating near Ford and General Motors manufacturing plants in Ragong, Thailand, in another attempt to evade a hefty tariff, with Thailand imposing a 60% tariff on imported motorcycles. Additionally, Harley assembles motorcycles in Brazil and has a wheel manufacturing plant in Australia. However, the Australia plant is planned to close. As a result of President Trump's trade war, which began on March 1st following Trump's announcement that he would impose tariffs on steel and aluminum, trade relations with China, Canada, Mexico, and the European Union have been at odds. Starting last week, on June 21st, the relationship between the EU and the U.S. has been particularly contentious, seeing as the EU imposed tariffs on a variety of American-made goods, such as bourbon, orange juice, and motorcycles. In the case of motorcycles, Harley reported an increased tariff of 31% for imported motorcycles to the EU, as opposed to the previous 6% tariff. This, on average, adds $2,200 to the price of every motorcycle exported to the EU, according to Harley. Harley issued a fair disclosure statement to their investors on June 25th, stating, quote, Harley Davidson believes the tremendous cost increase, if passed out onto its dealers and retail customers, would have an immediate and lasting detrimental implications to its business in the region, reducing customer access to Harley Davidson products and negatively impacting the sustainability of its dealers' businesses, end quote. Despite the possibility of the company losing up to an estimated $100 million a year due to the EU tariffs, according to the New York Times, Harley is hesitant to raise the prices for foreign markets. This is due to the fact that international sales continue to rise while domestic sales have been slowly falling. with international sales growing 2.3% and domestic sales falling 3.9% in 2016. While Trump has threatened to tax Harley in retaliation and U.S. labor unions decry the move abroad, Europe is Harley's second biggest market, and according to Harley, quote, Europe is a critical market for Harley-Davidson, end quote. They're unlikely to turn on their back in the European market.
Reality Winner, the former National Security Agency contractor who was arrested last year after allegedly giving top-secret information to the media regarding Russian hackers interfering in the 2016 election, has pled guilty. Winner's trial has been scheduled for October. However, her defense counsel has said pretrial rulings have frustrated her ability to mount a proper legal argument. It is anticipated under the terms of her plea deal that she will serve up to 5 years in prison. While serving in the Air Force, Winner held a top-secret security clearance and continued to handle classified information while working as a contractor for Pluribus International in Fort Gordon, Georgia. Winner's case is the first of its kind in which criminal charges were filed during the present administration, but since then, three other people have been charged in similar investigations.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Kahn, Summer Barraza, CJ Fritz, Emmett White, Yasmin Kobanoglu, and Teresa Mitchell. The producer, our engineer, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Elizabeth Venable.
And I'm Kyle Carezzi. And coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland. At 9 on Political Perspective, Linda Olsen Osterlund welcomes Code Pink, co-founder Medea Benjamin, to KBOO to discuss peace movements and in Iran and North Korea. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Recovery Zone talks to Paul Levy about his new book, The Quantum Revelation, a new paradigm for humanity revealed through the science of quantum theory. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Rose Haven is a sanctuary for women and children from street life, offering compassion, practical assistance, and community for those navigating the loss of a home, healing from abuse, and other disruptive experiences here in Portland, Oregon. And we have in the studio Rebecca Albert. Rebecca, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thank you for having me here today.
Yeah. So when a woman and her family, when they come from a destructive environment and they go to Rose Haven, what are the steps taken for a sound recovery?
Yes. Well, I should start by letting you know that Rose Haven is a private, standalone, nonprofit organization, and we're open to absolutely anyone who wants to come in for day shelter. We're the only full-service day shelter for women and children and LGBTQ community members in the city. And our focus for the last 20 years has been on providing a home base for the people that are a part of our community during the daytime hours when emergency night shelters are closed. So people who come to us during the daytime literally come from almost every other night shelter in the city and from the streets and under bridges and people who are living in their cars. And our purpose has always been to be that spot where people can start their day. So you can imagine what it would be like not to have a home to start your day in, to get a meal, to get cleaned up, to get ready for your day. And Rose Haven was really founded on the principle that every human being deserves that safe place during the daytime. And what we do is welcome everybody in. We provide all the basic services that we all need every day to get a start in our life, in our day. So we have fresh hot meals, we have showers, we have clean bathrooms, we have clean clothing, hygiene items. We offer voicemail and mailboxes, internet service, all the things that we all use every day just to queue up what we're going to do during that day. So for some people coming in, what they're going to need to do is just meet their basic needs for survival. They're going to need to eat, to sleep, probably get cleaned up. And for people actually living outside, we're going to be a safe space during the day where they can rest, because they certainly cannot do that at night in the street. For other people, we're going to be that place to get cleaned up, get ready for school or for work or for appointments. We have counselors and social workers who help people with one-on-one individual sessions to sort of plan a safety plan for them during the day. And we have a number of activities that people can be engaged in just to feel like they are part of a community. So that's what we do. We first try with everything we have to offer to help people feel connected to a community.
Mm-hmm. That all sounds very effective and important. Now, when was Rose Haven started?
Actually, Rose Haven was founded in 1998 by Sister Kathy Borboom. It was first a very small storefront in Old Town next to the police precinct. And the purpose then was exactly as it is now, though, just to provide that safe place for women to be during the daytime. Sister Kathy actually went on the streets of Old Town and met with homeless women and asked them what the gap was, what they really needed in terms of social services. So we do some format of that survey every year and have done for the last 19 years. And although conditions in the city and in people's lives have changed in some respects, that focus on resources during the daytime seems to remain the most important thing for women and children.
Mm-hmm. And who are the Sisters of Good Shepherd, and who is Mary Ephrasia?
Those are all really good questions. It's a part of our history. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, Sister Kathy Borboom is a sister. She's a Good Shepherd sister, and she, with a group of very committed volunteers and outreach folks, founded Rose Haven in 1998. As a Sister of Good Shepherd, she is part of an order that has existed almost 200 years. The foundress of the Sisters of Good Shepherd is Mary Euphrasia, and she founded the order post-Revolutionary War in France in Angers. And the focus then, as it is now with all Good Shepherd programs, is to provide programs that support and uplift women and children and really all people in communities that are marginalized, where they're marginalized. So there are literally Good Shepherd programs around the world. There are many Good Shepherd programs still in the United States. And Rose Haven is very proud of our heritage with Good Shepherd, but we are not legally tied to the Sisters of Good Shepherd. We are incorporated as a private nonprofit, but we certainly count them as our inspiration, and the values of Good Shepherd are really the founding stone of Rose Haven services.
Mm-hmm. And how many people do you think come by Rose Haven in a given day?
Okay, so, on an average, we would serve anywhere from 75 to 120 people a day. Mm-hmm. Last year, we served over 20,000 visits. We served 3,000, just short of 3,700 women and kids. And so anywhere from 70 to 100 women and kids a day, and really a growing number of LGBTQ and non-binary presenting folks in the community also access Rose Haven. That's really one of the most rapidly growing segments of the homeless population in our city. So they are welcome at Rose Haven, and we really enjoy having an growingly diverse population in our community.
Mm-hmm. And how long do you think it takes for people to use the programs at Rose Haven for them to get back on their feet, so to speak?
You know, that's really...
Or if that's an indefinite question.
Yeah. It really depends on what the situation is for the individual person. Mm-hmm. Some people come in and they're in a crisis due to domestic violence. They're having a really acute mental or physical health problem, and they're going to be with us to address those issues, and we will bring everything we have and all the community partners we have in to help that person really respond to their situation. And so sometimes those things can be resolved in a matter of months. We can get people connected with DV shelters. We can get them connected with the various medical and mental health care providers in the community. And we can see rapid changes and improvements in a person's situation in a period of months. But we serve probably half the people we serve are what would be identified as chronically homeless individuals. Mm-hmm. And those are people that for a variety of reasons come in and out of the status of experiencing loss of home over time, many, many times. And so their problems generally do include a form of abuse. Most women who are homeless have abuse issues, either before they leave home or are without a home or after they become homeless. And mental health issues, addiction issues, disability issues of many kinds crop up when a person is experiencing loss of home over periods of time. And so, you know, those conditions could be something that we're helping people address over a period of years.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. Is there anything that KBOO's listeners can do to help out Rose Haven in any way?
Yes. We always need volunteers. So you can hop on our website, which is www.rosehaven.org. You can find out about volunteering. And I do want you to know also that we are a very thrifty organization. It only costs us $189 per person per year to provide all the services that we do. So that comes out to be about 53 cents a day. And so you can donate to Rose Haven and support the people that we're helping just by jumping on the website. It's open to you 24/7, and whatever people can choose to give will be very much appreciated.
Mm-hmm. And again, what is the address for Rose Haven in the city?
Okay, so it's 627 Southwest 18th Avenue, Northwest 18th Avenue, and we're in the Alphabet District in Northwest Portland.
Okay. Well, Rebecca, thank you for joining us for the interview.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Good evening. The time is 5:57, and you are listening to the one, the only KBOO Portland. And up next at 6 o'clock is the Queer Boo Corner.
KBOO Community Radio cordially invites you to the Women of KBOO Celebration and Open House on Friday, June 29th from 7 to 10 p.m. It's here at the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Join us for the open house and an evening of on-air programming hosted by Barbara Bernstein and featuring Carol Major, Victoria Stapiello, and Maureen Key. We're celebrating the contribution of women volunteers, DJs, on-air hosts, staff, and board members in making KBOO what it is today. Light snacks and drinks will be provided. Everyone is welcome. Again, that's the Women of KBOO Celebration and Open House. It's on Friday, June 29th from 7 to 10 p.m. at KBOO 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Southeast Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm.
Love and I interested me so that I dared to knock at the door of the cosmos.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Solstice Celebration on Thursday, June 28th at 6:30 p.m. at EcoTrust in Portland. The Portland Solstice Celebration is a benefit party and open house in support of Rogue Farm Corps and their work training new farmers and preserving farmland. The event features live music, food and drinks, a raffle, and more. Again, that's the Portland Solstice Celebration on Thursday, June 28th from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at EcoTrust, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
Listening to KBOO Portland, and tonight on Queer Boo, we're going to play two episodes of This Way Out. One is going to be